My name is Evan White, and you're listening to the Stories on Stage Davis podcast. Regular listeners will know that in 2 weeks, on Saturday, April 24th, we are presenting a special live virtual event in partnership with the Yolo County Library, featuring acclaimed memoirist Raina Grande and an excerpt of her best-selling book, The Distance Between Us. The event will also feature an opening story by a current local high school student, selected by Grande herself. The evening also includes a Q&A with Grande. It promises to be a great night, and I hope you will join us. The event is free to attend, but registration is required. Find more on our website. Meanwhile, this week's episode features an excerpt of the memoir Model Citizen by Joshua Moore, who is also the author of Damascus, which the New York Times called Beat Poet Cool. Moore's novel All This Life won the Northern California Book Award. Reading Model Citizen is Eric Baldwin, who last read for our series in 2019 and has appeared in stage productions across North America and Europe. Stay tuned after the reading to hear Joshua Moore on the inspiration behind his story. But first, here's Eric Baldwin reading Model Citizen.
Model Citizen by Joshua Moore.
It's 6 in the morning on New Year's Day, and Ava cries from the crib, which means my wife says something to me like, "Your turn," and I say something whiny like, "Bottles, fine." And I stumble into the kitchen and spill milk on the counter and don't wipe it up. Leave it for later, after coffee, after caffeine makes my mind fire right. I tuck the bottle in the waistband of my drawers so I can hoist Ava up with both arms, and she says, "Let's play." A new phrase for her, and I carry her back into our bed and lay her in the middle, and get back in myself. Lilo and I flanking her, the three of us lying like a happy family, and for 20 seconds, that's what we are. Then the numbness starts. I notice it first in my right arm, and then I realize it's creeping into my leg. That's weird, I think. Two limbs falling asleep at the same time. Soon there is no feeling on that entire side of my body from shoulder to toes. I shift positions, rolling onto my back so blood can flow freely. 5 seconds. 10. 20. Still numb. Fear spills out of me like the milk rolling down my daughter's chin. I shake my dead hand back and forth, and I say to Lilo, "Something's wrong." And she says, "What?" And I say, 911. She's to the phone fast, and I roll over onto my stomach, a gesture that Ava interprets as an invitation to play, and she's straddling my back, yelling, "Hop on pop! Hop on pop!" My frantic wife doing her best to conjure the paramedics, and me knowing, beyond any doubt, that the numbness will zip over me like a body bag, and Ava keeps chanting, "Hop on pop! Hop on pop!" And I'm crying uncontrollably. Grieving a girl I'll never get to see turn into a woman, and if this is the end of my life, I wish it had ended sooner. Wish I had died before meeting Lilo, before ever seeing Ava on the ultrasound, the size of an orange seed, our nickname for her until she was born. I wish I had never gotten sober. Never tried to be a better person. Why endure so much harrowing improvement to die like this at 38 years old? In 2004, when I was in grad school at the University of San Francisco, I volunteered at a halfway house in the Mission District, teaching creative writing. Kay was one of my students at the halfway house. He had spent 15 years in San Quentin and was out 2 weeks when I met him. One of the conditions of his parole was that he had to stay clean or he'd be busted back to prison. After the first session we had together, he comes up to me and said,
"I'm going to be the first American Indian to win the National Book Award for nonfiction."
It made me like him immediately. Here he was, fresh from the penitentiary, and he had no fear of odds, no concept of how remote the chances were of that happening. Or did he know? And didn't care. Maybe winning the National Book Award seemed easy after pulling all those years in prison. The first essay he handed in made me think he might actually do it. The scene was short, maybe 4 or 5 paragraphs that dramatized Kay sitting on the sidewalk against the front of a 24-hour donut shop in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, the part of town where junkies roamed in an animal refuge. No police, no poachers, as long as they kept their chaos in a contained radius. This is changing as the city gentrifies, but back then, the TL was an addict asylum. In the scene, Kay was out of heroin, and he wore only an undershirt, and he'd never been so cold in his life, so hungry, so depleted. A taxi parked out front of the donut shop, the driver talking on his cell, arguing with someone. Kay watched words explode from the driver's mouth, and then he saw the exhaust puffing from the back tailpipe, looking like a steam room, giving him an idea. Freezing, Kay crawled, pulled himself across the sidewalk to the cab's back, first warming his hands in the exhaust, finally submerging his head in that toxic cloud, lathering himself in the car's warmth and affection. The story ended right there. The reader sucking carbon monoxide right along with Kay, smelling the acrid poison, but also feeling its billowy tenderness. I finished it, started right back at the beginning, reread it a few more times. This guy was good and needed help. Needed someone to treat him like he wasn't just another convict. "You might do it," I said to Kay, handing his essay back with my notes. Ways I thought he might make it better.
"Do what?"
"Win the National Book Award." He eyeballed me. Kay was in his 50s, dark complexion set off with patches of eczema which he constantly scratched. His head was kept in a crew cut, old and faded tribal tattoos on his forearms.
"Course I'll do it," he said.
They were always calling out, screwing around, and I dug their chaos during our classes. They didn't have to front tough. No one was a gangster while we wrote. Nobody had felonies hanging from their necks like nooses. We were people talking about storytelling, and that's all we were. I had one student who was illiterate. She came up to me and said, "Do you have to know reading for this class?" She was in her 40s. I stayed after our sessions and read our assignments to her. Usually she didn't like the stories I chose, saying something like, "These people is snobs." She was right. My first batch of stories was too much head and not enough heart. All the characters brandished vocabularies like weapons, but all it really did for them was provide more words to describe their disappointments in life. Everyone was in some sort of halfway house.
One time I was scheduled to teach the morning after Valentine's Day. My ex-wife, well, not my ex yet when this all happened. Blue was still my disappointed wife, my why-did-I-pick-this-guy wife, decided we should go out for a fancy Valentine's Day dinner. It was only one meal, after all. What could go wrong? I went from martinis to a few beers, and we drank a couple of bottles of champagne during the meal. And don't forget, after dinner drinks, we had to cocktail hard. Otherwise, there was this whole conversation thing. Couples have to talk, they say. We hadn't been talking much at all because earlier that week we'd had a huge fight. I'd done another dumb thing, so I bunked at Chaney's house, making up maudlin and self-sympathetic remixes of what had happened. Chaney was my best friend, and even she thought I was in the wrong. "Have you even apologized to her?" she said. "We both need to say we're sorry." So, no. Not yet. "If you want to fix this, go home." So I slunk back. I don't even think Blue took her eyes off the TV when I rolled in. Blue needed to believe in something, and I was not giving her much. We spent pretty much every night in one Mission District bar or another. Hell, we had fallen in love in dive bars. But recently she'd grown weary of going at it so hard every night, which didn't make sense to me. Weary? Of what? Of whiskey and jukeboxes and free peanuts? Of friends and adventures and bum smokes? Of giving a kiss to an angel you'll never see again? Of all singing along when Sister Christian played from cheap speakers? I'm not one of those sober cats who looks back and demonizes everything from when they were dirty. I'm glad I embarrassed myself all those nights because I learned what shame was. What shame is. It's impossible to describe real shame to someone who hasn't thrived on self-destruction. Kay wasn't having it. We met at a cafe close to the halfway house, around 15th and Mission, talking about his donut shop essay. I'd made a bunch of suggestions on how to make it better, but he didn't think it needed any improvements.
Already wrote it, he said. It's done.
You can make changes. Writers revise.
That's the whole story already on the page.
He was distracted, looking out the window, scratching his eczema. I was mad that he wasn't taking this meeting more seriously. I didn't get paid to teach there, so I sure as hell didn't get any money sitting in a cafe listening to someone say he wouldn't edit. Are you waiting for someone? I said, knocking on the window. He didn't even look at me.
Ain't got nobody to wait for.
Your story is pretty good, I said, trying to make him focus, but it can be great.
Used to grind right down there,
Kay said, pointing up 16th Street. There was a BART station, and everybody knew if you needed opiates or crack or crank in the mission, that was where you scored. I knew it intimately, buying bindles there myself, though I never told Kay.
Selling shit and getting high, he said. How am I supposed to stay clean living a block away?
You do it so you don't go back to prison, I said.
Easy as that, huh?
He still wasn't looking at me, staring out the window like he sat on an airplane and there was something panoramic below, the Grand Canyon, the Rocky Mountains, heroin.
Most of my life was standing on those corners.
Do you want to talk about your essay?
No, he said. I don't.
Here was what caused my fight with Blue earlier that Valentine's week. I was super coked up and had at least 10 Fernets swimming in me when I met her and a couple of girlfriends. I'd been bartending right around the corner and got off at midnight and hoofed to Laszlo so we could all cocktail. I knew the guys slinging drinks there pretty well, Rick and Brian, who had a whole Brokeback Mountain thing going on, except instead of illicit fishing trips, they blew dunes of coke and slow danced while the sun came up, much to the chagrin of Brian's wife. Me walking over and kissing Blue and saying hey to her friends and immediately heading to the bar to buy the table around, having a quick pop with the Brokeback Brigade and striking up a conversation with the woman next to me, some debutante all dressed up, slumming it in the mission. I dealt with these posh ladies all the time on the weekends behind my own bar as they turned our neighborhood into the dirty marina. The rich seeing how the paupers lived. At least that's how it was back then. Now the mission is the marina. And I hated these crosstown tourists, but also Doug making them want to screw me. And cocaine made me a charming chauvinist, who some women found irresistible, and apparently this lady was one of those because she flirted right off. And I looked her up and down, and she wore these crazy jeweled shoes that looked like chandeliers, and some belligerent carnival barker in my head demanded that I drink whiskey from one of them stat. Which I said to her, making her giggle and bite her bottom lip, and I said, what's funny? She said, you're crazy. And I said, you got that right, pretty lady, and leaned down, slipping off one of her shoes, and my wife was at a corner table, having no idea that I was being such a scumbag, simply chatting with her friends, waiting for me to come back with a round of drinks, enjoying a normal night cocktailing until the moment she couldn't stand me anymore, and though that was still moments away, me trying to convince one of those Brokeback blokes to pour whiskey straight into this girl's shoe, and either Rick or Brian asking her, you okay with this? And she pointed at me and laughed and said, he's crazy. And Brian and Rick already knew that, of course, and poured whiskey into her shoe, my chalice. And the music thumped some Chicago break beats, and most people at the bar started cheering when I brought the shoe to my lips and slurped out all the booze, and the woman whose shoe it was clapping and making sorority-style squeals, and I asked the debutante if she wanted to dance, and she said, sure, and I said, not here. She said, where? I still had her shoe in my hand, and I knocked on the bar with it and said, up there. And she squealed again, and I jumped on the bar and pulled her up there, too, and we let the music take over, dancing terribly, me flying the shoe all about, doing my whole King of the Bar shtick, dancing with spirits and blow and a squealing debutante. I wonder if Blue saw me herself, or if one of her friends had to point toward the bar and ask, is that your husband up there? I wonder what went through her mind, turning to look, having witnessed countless of my idiotic shenanigans. Each of them tangling together, creating a huge ball of humiliations, too much for one wife to take. And it was over. I was over. We were over. I'd gone too far, not with the outlandishness of this one incident per se, but the speeding boulder of all the times I embarrassed Blue. And I bet she didn't even answer her friend. I bet she simply stood and stormed, and all the ire coursed through her and out her fingertips. I never saw her coming. One second dancing and zooming the shoe in zigzags, and the next feeling pressure on the backs of my legs. Feet leaving the bar. Weight flipping in a slow motion tumble. I must have dropped the shoe, must have brought my hands up to protect my face. Must have thought it was the debutante's bow or a jilted one-night stand. It never occurred to me that Blue might mastermind this violent fate. Still falling, still feeling my legs whipping up until I was upside down, I crashed face first to Laszlo's floor. Landed and lay there. And then it was like the whole room vanished. All the other people gone. Except the two of us. Blue and me. Music nixed. The shining shoe sitting on the floor. Blue standing above me. The look in her eyes was all anger. At this drunk she'd tethered herself to. At this person. Too dense to treat other people with dignity. I lay there, bleeding, in my head all sideways, shocked, but also proud of our life's chaos. Loved all the shoves I never saw coming. The shoe chandelier should have been my headstone, a lighthouse tossing watts to mark the grave of a lousy husband. A whimpering eulogy flitting on the wind saying, "A parasite, a wrecking ball, a waste." Kay and I met before or after class for the next couple of weeks. I'd worn him down about revision, about the idea that a story needs more work after its initial conception. I did this by sharing a couple of my short stories with him. I showed him the rough drafts and then the final, published products. Which is better?
"These is shit," he said, meaning the rough drafts. "These is solid," he said, pointing at the finals.
"So will you revise the donut shop piece?" I said. "I can help you publish it."
"How do you want to help me?"
"I want you to win the National Book Award."
"I was playing about that," said Kay. "Can't win."
"You can," I said. "You're super talented." Kay smiled.
"You think?"
Back to Valentine's Day, where Blue and I were stuck with wonderful French fruit in front of us and having a terrible time. She could barely look at me. From her perspective, dancing on the bar with that woman was the latest example of me disrespecting her. I had bad boundaries with the opposite sex. She knew it, and I knew it, and everyone we ran around with knew it, and that's what made her so pissed, how public it all was. A couple of free Fernets with a bartender on our way out the door. He and I had watched the sunrise a few times, telling our war stories at mock speeds, the cocaine making us sprint through our life's woes. I can't remember his name, but I can tell you that his mom used to beat him with a hairdryer. Blue and I were specifically calling it an early night so I could be semi-coherent at the halfway house in the morning. I had to be there at 9 a.m., and I didn't want to show up stinking of booze. The people there worked so hard to clean up their lives, and I liked pretending that I was trying too. But the cops had other ideas of how this Valentine's Day was going to end. Sirens and a failed field sobriety test. Blue taking a cab home and me heading to the drunk tank. Another night wedged in a cell with a bunch of hammerheads. The highlight was always a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, early in the morning. Did I really like them, or is that only how I'm remembering it now? I remember those sandwiches tasting like they were made by God. The almighty creator sticking a knife into each jar, getting the proportions just right.
I brought a couple of books that I thought would help Kay dig into his rewrite. The first was Dennis Johnson's Angels. The other was Amy Hempel's Reasons to Live. Those writers did emotional filth like few others. They'd be good role models on the page for Kay. Somebody buzzed me into the halfway house, and one of the supervisors called me into the office. She collated a huge mound of pages into a bunch of smaller stacks. She was fast at it. In another life, she would have been the most sought-after dealer in Vegas. "Kay got busted back," she told me. "What?" "He failed a piss test." "So he's in jail?" "In county now, then back to the pen." "For how long?" "For the rest of his suspended sentence," she said, not looking up at me, just slamming new pages down in the stacks. "That was a provision of his parole." "How long is his suspended sentence?"
I got no idea, she said.
But it could be years.
She actually laughed at this. Oh, it's definitely years, she said. Do you know what he did to get knocked up in the first place? Why? I asked her. I knew she wouldn't be able to tell me anything. Certainly not what I needed to hear. The information I was after could only come from Kay. She stopped collating that massive stack of papers. Why what, Josh? Why did he relapse? The woman shrugged. There has to be a reason, I said. No, she said. There doesn't. Happens every day. She kept slapping pages down onto her swelling stacks. I left the office and went to the room the students and I met in and wrote, Class canceled, on the dry erase board. I stormed out of the halfway house and threw the books I had brought for Kay into the trash. On the days I didn't have MFA classes, I tended bar at a place over on Valencia. I was scheduled to work that day, but my shift didn't start for like 7 hours. Time suddenly delegated to a wake, a funeral, a proper send-off for Kay. I hit the closest dive bar and ordered a shot of tequila, a beer in a can. I made a cheesy eulogy cheers for Kay and downed my shot. What's going on? The bartender said once I chugged the whole beer. He wanted to chum it up since we were the only people there. Without asking, he got me another tequila, Anticate. He's gone, I said, and threw the tequila back. Kay had quit. He had one last shot to get his shit together, and he couldn't. And all those years in prison that could have been avoided regenerated around his body. Steel bars, cement, sealing him away from any future. If the stakes were that high for him and he couldn't stay clean, what chance did I have? Sure, I ruptured a marriage, but that was nothing compared to Kay or the others at the halfway house. Maybe I'd get divorced, fired. None of those offenses would lead me to San Quentin. Without any serious penalties, I was going to keep punishing myself. It was the punishment that got me high. In my early 20s, living in a punk house in the Sunset District, I suggested a game of beer bottle baseball. I handed somebody a bat in our living room and stood like 15 feet in front of him, and I lobbed a beer bottle, and he hit it and smashed it, and shards of glass flew everywhere, cutting the shit out of my face. And I was laughing like the animals laughed once they realized Noah's Ark was going to float. And I kept pitching bottles and people kept clubbing the glass to bits. And each and every cut on my face was where it was supposed to be. Every cut was perfect. Another? The bartender asked, probably wondering what was taking me so long with the new tequila shot. I'm going to drink until I black out. I've heard worse ideas, he said. The morning after my failed sobriety test, the heavenly PB&J, they let me out of jail around 8 a.m. I had to get to the halfway house to teach. I really wanted to go that morning. It felt important, doing something for other people. I stopped by a store and bought a pack of gum and a bottle of Gatorade. There was no time to take a shower or brush my teeth. I knocked on the halfway house's door and somebody buzzed me in. The class started in 2 minutes. The number of students fluctuated based on who had job interviews, who had to work, who had house responsibilities. The week before, we'd had 15 students, which was a record, and I thought that class was our best yet, and we'd build on it, and things would get stronger. Which made it even worse the day I came straight from jail. That morning, I walked into the classroom, and no one was there. Not one student. It was 9 a.m., and I figured I'd give them a grace period. We all need a grace period. It was impossible that nobody would show. We'd had small classes before, maybe 4 or 5. Never 0, though. That couldn't happen. I sat there by myself until 9:30, and the only reason I got up was that I started crying. There I was, a drunk in the bathroom of a halfway house, the biggest wreck on the premises, and I didn't even live there. I had to get out. The longer I stayed, the better the odds that I was going to be discovered, exposed for who I really was. I heard Shaney's voice saying, "If you want to fix this, go home." "I don't know how," I said to the empty bathroom. Me, you, any stranger standing around and watching, we would have messed up that morning at the donut shop. We'd have seen sadness as Kay crawled across the sidewalk to warm himself in a fart of carbon monoxide. See, to Kay, there was no tailpipe. No taxi. No driver. Kay didn't take in any of that. He saw a house. Saw a mother making sing-song syllables to a baby in a bathtub. Saw kindness coming out of that exhaust pipe. Saw nourishment, grace, saw exactly what he needed to survive another day. And isn't that all any of us are after? Won't we do anything to survive? There's no such thing as the long view when you're freezing, when you're broken. There's only the shortest path to the tailpipe. Life isn't about the comforts we covet. It's about the kinds we can crawl inside.
This is Joshua Moore, and you just heard an excerpt of my memoir, Model Citizen. I've never worked so hard on a book as I have putting Model Citizen together, and it was an absolute blast, despite it taking me into some dark terrain. It was the most meaningful experience that I've had so far as an artist, having the opportunity to write this memoir as a love letter to my daughter. She was the impetus for putting this to paper in the first place, trying to leave some sort of record for her. If my doctors prove to be correct and I don't live out of my 40s, I want her to know who her father was during his short time here. I appreciate all of you taking the time tonight to listen along. It's been my pleasure.
You've just heard an excerpt of the memoir Model Citizen by Joshua Moore, read by Eric Baldwin. If you've enjoyed listening, consider sharing this episode with a friend. And if you really enjoyed it, please consider making a donation on our website to help us keep sharing stories like these. The Stories on Stage Davis podcast is a sponsored project of YOLO Arts, a nonprofit arts organization, and supported in part by a grant from the City of Davis Arts and Cultural Affairs Program. Find upcoming episodes, view our archive of past episodes, and help support our series at storiesonstagedavis.com.